You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 18th to the 24th of July 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Jack Grove, books editor Karen Shook and deputy news editor John Morgan. We have several stories from the magazine for you this week. Our splash is on one university's plan to assess academics' performance according to the number of students receiving at least a 2-1 in their modules. But that was popular. We have a feature on India's five-year plan, a rather apt cricket theme to that one, given that the second Ashes test kicks off today. And we'll also have an overview of this week's book section, including our book of the week, which is Isaac versus Isaiah, the covert punishment of a Cold War heretic. And finally, we'll take a quick look at a couple of gems from our annual exam Howlers Award. But first up, Jack, you had the splash this week, and you can reveal which university it was that was planning to, correct me if I've got this wrong, assess its academics on the basis of how many of their students got a 2-1 in their class.
Yes, well, this was a story concerning Surrey University. And around this time, I imagine lots of academics have just been through their annual appraisal. And I was looking at some documents that Surrey had prepared for how they hope to alter their appraisal process. And one of the things that really struck me was this a line in it which said that academics were to be judged on the percentage of students receiving a mark of 60% or above for each module taught, and they had to demonstrate a personal contribution towards how they'd help these students to receive the 2-1. And this went down very badly at Surrey because they felt that they were under pressure to give higher marks. So an academic who was had a student who was on the borderline between, say, a 2-1 and a 2-2 would really feel the pressure to bump that person up to a 2-1 because their job was essentially on the line. They were being assessed on the amount of students getting 2-1s, and they had to have a certain amount of students. And so this is a debate about degree inflation, really, and whether academics are under pressure to put up marks because students now are paying £9,000 a year and they really need to have a 2-1 to enter the marketplace with a 2-1 on their CV. So, you know, whether the 2-1, 2-2 first system is really fit for purpose anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about grade point averages possibly being introduced, but surely inflating the number of students with 2-1s just devalues the degree even more. I mean, the £9,000 a year, you know, you might say there's more pressure on the students themselves, but the university shouldn't feel that pressure. Surely they should assess as they see fit.
Well, that's the thing. Surrey felt that they were marking grades quite fairly, but in the past they'd felt that some of their students were unjustifiably getting lower marks compared to comparable institutions where similar standard students were getting high levels of 2-1. So they wanted to make sure that their students weren't being unfairly penalised.
Karen, looks like you have a thought on
by
that.
Overly rigorous academics. I mean, there's a whole train of you can't even call them unintended consequences because you wouldn't even need to get a 2-2 to work out how this might play itself out.
Exactly. I mean, there's this sort of this was the fear that there'll be a sort of if everyone's comparing each other, saying, "Well, this institution's got higher levels of 2-1s, we need to be up there." It's a sort of a race to the bottom, or a race to the 2-1, where, you know, every university feels that a certain amount of their students should get 2-1s, and I think now 66% of students overall are getting a 2-1 or a first, and that's 5% up on just a few years earlier.
Well, I think the pressure should be on the student more than the university, and I'm not surprised it was an unpopular policy move. But you can read all about that story in this week's lead news item. John Morgan, the cover feature this week, it came out of your visit to India earlier in the year, an immensely ambitious nation when it comes to higher education. What's it all about?
So India has a planning commission, which is part of the government, and it sets five-year plans. We're probably one of the few nations to still do this. And
they've always been very popular.
And India's five-year plan is to increase its student enrolments by another 10 million students, at the same time as really raising quality. So I visited a number of Indian universities. Particular highlight was going to the University of Pune, where the Vice-Chancellor is housed in what was once the Governor of Bombay's house in the times of the Raj, which was rather spectacular. And some of the things that came out of that, which are that there's a real feeling that there's a shortage of good quality academics, well-trained academics to do the teaching, poor infrastructure. Even the Planning Commission within the Indian government talks about outdated and irrelevant curricula and bemoans the lack of Indian universities making the top 200 of world university rankings and the lack of world-class research. So there's, for such a sort of hugely ambitious nation, as you said, there's a real worry about the quality of the higher education system.
Yeah, it is those rankings, isn't it, coming back again and again. I mean, obviously we have our own rankings, which I know every year they come out, are inundated with inquiries and queries from scholars and academics in India asking why they're not breaking through to that top ranking that we publish. I mean, is this sort of influencing the way policymakers work out there?
It very much is. Yeah, this is part of the official language used by the Planning Commission. Is the absence of Indian universities and at the top of world university rankings, and a number of the objectives they set out kind of relates to getting more universities in the top of the rankings. So prioritizing the research funding on kind of the top faculty and the top institutions would be, part of that goal, that they hope that will have the end result, that they have high-ranking universities at the end of it. So it does have a policy impact.
But that's quite tricky, isn't it, if you're focusing on improving quality, but you're also trying to provide mass higher education. I mean, that's the thing. It's very hard to, 10 million additional students, that's like five times the size of the whole UK sector, and that's an additional capacity that they're trying to create and create quality as well. I mean, it's very, very ambitious.
Yeah, absolutely. And 59% of the enrolments are in private institutions in India. They're not in the real high-end institutions. So in a sense, you're right, talking about the elite institutions isn't really addressing the heart of the issue. And I talked to a number of people from private universities, and there are some very interesting issues there about the fact that students and parents are often required to pay for admission in these institutions, and
then to pay for admission as well as for their tuition.
Yeah, there's something called a capitation fee, which is
making a universal symbol for backhand.
under the table payment that I was told is in operation in 99.9% of private institutions in India. And then these private institutions are often themselves required to pay kickbacks to state governments to get a license to set up in particular states. But the growth is going to have to come in the private institutions to get to meet this target for 10 million students. And there's quite an interesting debate over whether those institutions should be allowed to become for profit, which they're currently not, to allow them to expand to create these.
Sounds like there
places.
Is some profit operating there, just perhaps some, on an
some,
individual
some,
level.
Some people are making money, but not in legitimate ways.
No, it's a fascinating piece. Do check it out this week. Before we carry on, I should flag up a second podcast that's now available on the Times Higher Education website and also on iTunes, I should add. Although you're listening to a podcast, so you probably knew that anyway. But it's the fifth in our series of dedicated books podcasts and features author Rachel Bowlby in conversation with our own books editor Karen Shook. They cover all sorts from the role of parenthood in a range of literary works to the social and personal impact of developments in reproductive technology. So do check that out. But Karen is with us now to tell us a little bit more about this week's book section. Karen, what do you have for us?
This week's book of the week is written by an acclaimed historian who is also a novelist, playwright, and I would say perhaps a rebel in the academic hierarchy. He quit All Souls College, the University of Oxford, over their failure to reform. This was back in 1965. The author is David Cott. He has written a book about a couple of academics and their long-standing feud. The book is Isaac and Isaiah, The Covert Punishment of a Cold War Heretic. It's obvious that Cott, who I think is clear is on the left, is sympathetic to what happened to Isaac Deutscher, who was essentially blackballed, Cott says, by the revered academic Isaiah Berlin, who I think is a watchword in many people's view for academic probity and the highest caliber of scholarship. But it would appear, according to our reviewer Roger Morgan's assessment, who himself was at the University of Sussex, that what Berlin did when Deutscher was being considered for a job at the University of Sussex was morally questionable. He essentially ensured that someone whose politics he didn't agree with, Deutscher was on the left, certainly quite far on the left by most standards, ensured that he didn't get the job. It's a great and terrifying story of some quite unedifying academic backstabbing and skullduggery, and I'm sure that readers will wonder whether there are any parallels with today. However, it's a cracking story, and it's beautifully written by a historian whose literary works are beyond question. But I think it's fair to say that he's not saying any of this is fiction. Elsewhere, we have Roger Brown, our higher education expert among experts, looking at Raising the Stakes, Gambling with the Future of Universities, which is written by two academics from Australia. Unsurprisingly, they find many of the same challenges to the higher education system there. And as Roger Brown points out, whither goes the UK, goeth many other countries, and certainly Australia is grappling with the idea of trying to find a middle way between the market and the state system. We've also got a review of Elizabeth's Bedfellows, which looks at the ladies of the bedchamber and Elizabeth the First Time, mm-hmm. a book on leadership in mostly the private sector, reviewed by a very eminent scholar of public leadership, Jean Hartley at the Open University Business School, and Colin Higgins at St. Catherine's College, Cambridge, looks at a wonderful book about women writers in the British Museum, from George Eliot to Virginia Woolf. The book's called Roomscape, and Colin wonderfully points out how Virginia Woolf compared the British Museum's round reading room to a huge bald forehead.
Wonderful. Well, there you go, from bald foreheads and books to bloopers, I guess. As I said at the start, we this week publish the shortlist, I guess it can be called, for our annual Exam Howlers competition, which looks at sort of amusing typos and errors that lecturers come across while they're assessing their students. I will give an example. One of our readers discovered a student saying that sex has puzzled biologists ever since it was discovered by Darwin and Mendel. An unpleasant image, if ever there was one. Another, General Franco was supported, apparently, by right-wing panties. And I notice our art desk has illustrated that with the typical creative flair. Although I'd say maybe the panties are being supported by General Franco in that image, but you'll have to look at that for yourselves.
We couldn't see what he was wearing below the waist, to be honest. The panties were in his hand.
That's very true. I sort of man the Times Higher Twitter feed as well as sort of writing for the magazine, and I know for a fact we'll get a few people observing this competition and saying, oh, well, is it, you know, should we be highlighting this? Should we be chuckling along? I mean,
unkind and in poor taste.
It's
not thoughtful to those poor students who are struggling with the difference between parties and panties.
Precisely, yeah.
Well, I think that it's a very light-hearted competition. Lots of these mistakes are made under the pressure of the exam, and often it's just a sort of slip of the pen, a spelling mistake, or a spoonerism unintended. And I think students will laugh about it just as much as academics, and it just sort of lightens the season of marking for lots of academics, knowing that there's a few sort of howlers in there, a few mistakes that they can share with their friends and with other Times Higher Education readers.
And it's anonymous, of course, so the only people who know that they're guilty are the ones who did the crimes.
Are the ones who conjured up the vision of Darwin and Mendel locked in a carnal embrace.
And on that bombshell, we should bring this podcast to an end. But there's all those stories and more in this week's Times Higher Education. Do check them out either in the hard copy or at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You can discuss them on our LinkedIn group page. They'll also be posted on our new LinkedIn company page, which you'll find by searching for Times Higher Education. We're on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. We're on Facebook. There's a group there, have a search for us, and we're also on Google+, so you've no excuse for not taking part in the debates. But the debate for today is over. We'll be back next week with another Times Higher Education issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.